Last month, Apple admitted to secretly recording the locations of thousands of iPhone users. And the GPS maker TomTom confessed to selling data collected from its users, data that the Dutch police then used to set up speed traps. Smartphones, GPS, EasyPass, they all know where we are. How comfortable are you with giving up privacy for convenience? This hour, we'll talk about controlling your privacy. Senator Al Franken joins us. He's holding a hearing next week on the subject. Plus, from MTV star to Silicon Valley CEO, electronic music pioneer, the man behind the hits She Blinded Me With Science and Hyperactive, Thomas Dolby joins us. He's back with a new album. And the video pick of the week, Rocks That Glow in the Dark, after this break. Our goal is to keep these podcasts free. Here's how you can help.
You can support the show by trying GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Use GoToMeeting to bring people together, colleagues and clients across the country or around the world, to collaborate in real time. For your free 30-day trial, visit GoToMeeting.com and use the promo code SCIENCE. Here's another free offer. Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite is designed to automatically back up files on PCs and Macs before hard drive crashes, viruses, or other problems occur. To try it free and support the show, visit Carbonite.com and use the offer code Science Friday.
Thank you, Anna. And now, on to the show. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Recognize this song? Of course, it's She Blinded Me With Science, a huge hit from the 80s and one of the most fun science-inspired songs ever. The singer is Thomas Dolby. He was a pioneer in early synthesizer pop music, and his stage shows were full of crazy gadgets, knobs, and retro technology. But he is also the man behind another familiar tune. Of course, that's the musical cell phone ringtone. Thomas Dolby left the music industry 20 years ago for a career in Silicon Valley. His company made the polyphonic ringtone synthesizer that's in over 3 billion phones. Chances are you have time, or you have him to thank him for your cell phone ringer. How could you not remember that cell phone tone? Dolby is making a comeback this year in the music industry. He has a new EP out with a very different sound, and he's here to talk about music and technology. Thomas Dolby is a musician, a producer, and the founder of Beatnik Incorporated, and music director of the TED Conferences. His new EP is called Oceania. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Very nice to be with you.
Thank you very much. You know, science nerds everywhere are forever indebted to you for making science sound so cool.
I thought it was you guys that made my song a hit.
I wish we had been around that long. We've only been around 20 years, not 30. But thank you for the compliment. Well, compliment. In the 80s, you used all sorts of retro gadgets in your shows. Did you always love old technology?
I love things that used to be modern. You know, I love H.G. Wells and Jules Verne and stuff like that. And the technology that excites me most is the stuff that is so new that it's mind-boggling and nobody really knows what to do with it. And as an artist, I sort of step up and go, oh, I've got an idea what you can do with it.
Mm-hmm. And your new music, which we're going to play a little bit later, from your new EP, is very different. I mean, it's almost like it's going back to the 50s sounds a bit.
It's a lot more organic, I think,
yeah,
than the sound that people are probably familiar with. And, you know, the thing is, you know, 30 years ago when I was working with electronics, they were very rare and expensive. I mean, my first Fairlight cost me $100,000, and only myself, Peter Gabriel, and Kate Bush had them. So, of course, I felt like a pioneer. But these days, for $1.99, you can get an iPhone app that does more than my Fairlight did back then. And so that's great news for people that want to dabble, you know, with music. It's really for every man at this point. But for somebody like myself, I can no longer feel like a pioneer because statistically, the chances are somebody somewhere in the world has come up with the same exact combination of sounds that I did. Mm-hmm. So I've never run with the herd, you know. So I've gone back the other way. I've gone back to songwriting because I can do that uniquely. And I think that, you know, the personality behind the songs is what really sets my music apart.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't do it just to get back into the retro age of vacuum tubes and vinyl coming back?
I see, you know, toys and devices as a means to an end, really. It's all about the music at the end of the day. I don't think that, you know, I mean, there are geeks who care a lot about how music is made, but at the end of the day, when you hear a great piece of music or a lovely melody or a lovely voice, it communicates with you on an emotional level, and it transcends the technology that was used to create it.
I noticed that a couple of songs on your EP are sort of environmental named. Is that on purpose?
Well, I think it's a lot of that's down to the environment that I made them in. I live back in the UK now on the East Coast facing the North Sea. And in my garden, instead of the proverbial sort of garden shed studio that a lot of musicians seem to have these days, our garden floods from time to time. So I put my studio in a vintage lifeboat from the 1930s, and I got local traditional boat builders to build me a fabulous control room in the wheelhouse. And I look out over the sea in one direction and marshes in another direction, and the power comes from a wind turbine on the mast and solar panels on the roof. So whenever it's windy and sunny enough, I've got enough power to do some music. So obviously, working under those kind of conditions is going to have a huge influence on what you hear, not least because there's no soundproofing, so every time the boat creaks, you hear it in the, on the mic.
Do you need a foghorn?
All the time.
Why did you leave the music industry after having so much success with it? You dropped out for a couple of decades.
Yeah, well, you know, at the end of the 80s, the beginning of the 90s, the music industry seemed to be going sort of into a recession. And it's a very bad time for showbiz in general. It was the Gulf War, you know, and so on. And I saw some very exciting possibilities in the world of technology, the internet, video games, virtual reality, eventually the web, and eventually mobile phones and so on. And rather than be in the music industry, which was trying to dig in its heels and slow down the rate of progress, I wanted to go to Silicon Valley and help accelerate it. So I went there initially to help companies like Apple and Microsoft and so on get sound and music into their products. And over time, it became sort of a killer app, especially for people like Apple. And so it was much more interesting for me, given my inclination to work as a pioneer, to be in Silicon Valley at that point rather than in the music industry.
Mm-hmm. Did you know Robert Moog and people like that?
Yeah, I mean, I'd brushed shoulders with all of those guys, yeah. And obviously I'd always tried to talk to them about the developments they were making. But I suppose eventually when I got a taste for that, I thought, well, I want to start my own company here and make my own products. And so that was what gave birth to Beatnik.
Are you going to start touring again?
Absolutely, yeah. I'm gonna be touring at the end of this year when my album comes out. But that hopefully will be with a full band.
Is there anything in particular about science that you found interesting as a child at all? Did that influence the themology of your music?
I mean, I think I'm a dabbler, really. You know, I never had the patience to really be a good scientist. I like to sort of see flashes of inspiration in all sorts of different things. But I'm at my most creative when I don't really know what on earth I'm doing. When I'm sort of fumbling around trying to find out how something works, that's when I have to be a little bit ingenious and come up with an innovative solution.
Tell us what it's like for you to be an observer on the music industry, watching the music industry change so much over your career. What is your impression of it?
Well, it needed to change because it was kind of a bit broken. But I actually think that now is a very exciting time for the music industry, and I'll tell you why. I mean, if you're a 17-year-old kid now with musical talent, you believe that the moment the world hears your music, they're going to fall in love with you, and you'll be a superstar overnight. And today, that's actually possible. No guarantees, but it is actually possible. When I started out, I thought the same thing, but it turned out that actually before the public fell in love with me, first I had to get a tape to an A&R man and then sign a contract, and the marketing department had to have a window, and then the radio programmers and retail, and only when I'd got through that whole obstacle course would the public actually get to listen to my music and decide for itself. So, I mean, I think that, the way the music industry is going is very, very healthy for music, and I think there's great music being made these days, probably behind closed doors or in high schools, and that we haven't even imagined. Hmm. So I think the way forward is a very healthy one.
And the fact that anybody can put their own video up on YouTube and get skirt that whole industry, all those hoops that you'd have to jump through.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you look at Jessie J, who you know, a couple of months ago was in her bedroom in her pajamas doing, you know, little YouTube videos, and suddenly she's a global superstar. So it really can happen these days, and I think that's fantastic.
And so you see all the social media as a very positive thing.
Well, I think it's incredibly positive. It's also, you know, the other thing that's great about it for an artist is that the public knows when I'm writing a song, who I'm collaborating with. You know, they might get to hear a rough mix late at night for it that's up on the net for a couple of hours, and then I'll take it down again. They might hear a new version of the song with a redesigned second verse next month. And 5 years from now, the music I do today will still have a shelf life. And this is a great thing because this is the way artists work and the way we feel. We're not geared up for, you know, street dates and release schedules and marketing windows and stuff like that. It was very much a construct of the record industry when it was all about manufacturing. But I think that in this virtual world, it's a much healthier way to live, really, as an artist.
And because everybody can have their own synthesizer and make their own music today, would that be one of the reasons why you went back to the non-electronic instruments?
You know, my motto is very much only do what only you can do. And I think that, you know, in the 80s when I started out, although there were many different artists and musicians working with electronics, the difference really with my songs was that they were compositions that I could have sat down at the piano and played to you, and you still would have got a feeling for the song, for the atmosphere, for the flavor, the personality of the song. So the synths that I was using were there to embellish that and add layers of texture and so on, but what was underlying was, you know, a very strong songwriting sense. And so that's what I'm focused on today, because I think today that's the rarefied commodity. There's electronics up the wazoo, but there's very few people writing great songs.
Well, I want to thank you very much for taking time to be with us today, and good luck to you and on your new album and on your tour.
Thanks, Lara. See you soon.
See you soon. Thomas Dolby is a musician and producer. He's the co-founder of Beatnik Incorporated and musical director of the TED Conferences. His new EP is called Oceania. And we'll give you a little flavor of that. Thomas Dolby's new album. This song is called To the Lifeboats. We're going to take a lifeboat break ourselves. We'll be right back after this break. Stay with us. To help keep these podcasts free, we need your support. Here's Anna to tell you how.
Thanks, Ira. This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by GoToMeeting.com, the award-winning web conferencing application for Macs and PCs. One of the ways business gets done these days is by bringing people together, sharing ideas, and collaborating. And more, the people you want to work with are across town, or on the other side of the country, or even around the world. So how can you help them make the best possible contribution to your business or project? It's simple. GoToMeeting. GoToMeeting is the web conferencing tool which enables colleagues and clients from remote locations to see your computer desktop on their computer screen, which means you can collaborate from a distance, form closer relationships, and be more effective. Use GoToMeeting for virtual meetings, product demos and reviews, sales presentations, training sessions, and status updates, just about any type of meeting. You can schedule GoToMeetings in advance or hold them on the fly. Try GoToMeeting today and receive a free 30-day trial and help Science Friday, too. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click Try It Free, and enter the promo code SCIENCE. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code SCIENCE. Make your next meeting a GoToMeeting instead. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone. Now, back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Up next, privacy and your gadgets. You going out to see Grandma for Mother's Day? Well, remember the old days when you take a road trip, piling the kids in the back of the station wagon, grabbing those dusty, folded-up road maps, heading out the door? And don't forget some quarters for the toll booth. Well, these days, a trip to Grandma's or the Grand Canyon might be a little easier. You've got your GPS system to navigate, your cell phone so you can call someone if you get lost. You got an easy pass that gets you through the toll booth. All these modern conveniences. But they do come at the cost of your privacy. Is it okay with you for the companies that make these gadgets to keep track of where you're heading that day? Or how fast you got there? Should consumers have some say over who collects data on these gadgets and how it's used? That's what we'll be talking about next. We want to hear from you. Are you okay with your gadgets keeping track of where you are? A number of bills are in Congress seeking to protect your privacy. Senator Al Franken of Minnesota is holding a hearing on the issue next week. He'll be joining us in just a little bit. On the other hand, maybe you're glad your phone can check you in on Foursquare or on Facebook and keep track of where you're going, and you are willing to give up some of your privacy. In any case, tell us what you think. Our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry at SCIFRI or go to our Facebook page at /SciFry on Facebook and get a conversation going right there also. Let me introduce my guest. Justin Brookman is the Director of Consumer Privacy at the Center for Democracy and Technology in Washington. He joins us from our NPR studios there. Thanks for talking with us today.
Sure, anytime.
Welcome to Science Friday. Larry Downs is the author of The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age. He's also a blogger for CNET and Forbes. He's a senior fellow at the think tank Tech Freedom. He joins us from the campus of UC Berkeley. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Edward Felton is the chief technologist for the Federal Trade Commission. He is currently on leave from Princeton University and talking to us today from the campus. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Felton.
Thanks. I'm happy to be here.
Let me begin the conversation with some of the events that happened during the last few weeks. Larry Downs, tell us what Apple did and why people were so angry with that.
Well, it's not entirely clear what they did. They've told us now what they did, and I tend to believe these reports. But some researchers discovered that there were files on the iPhones that seemed to have some location information stored on them, and people jumped to the conclusion that that information was information about the phone itself and the user. It took Apple a few days to respond. When they did, they explained that, no, it was a file of hotspots and cell towers near where the phone had been collected from other devices. But in the meantime, of course, the panic had set in.
And you wrote an article in CNET, basically, about this incident, saying that people have made a mountain out of a molehill here.
Yeah, and it's a natural, I think, visceral response we have in the age where new applications and services do make use of personal information in interesting new ways. We always have what I refer to as the queasy factor when we first start using those applications. But over time, as we understand what they do and the benefits of them, we tend to adapt very quickly.
Justin Brookman, your take on this.
Yeah, so I thought what Apple did, I thought they did a good job in quickly dialing back and said, you know what, this is a bug, this is a mistake. But I think there were real privacy issues here. I mean, there's a file on your phone that was saying pretty much where you were over an extended period of time. And the researchers found that it was up to over a year in some instances. And the file wasn't organized that way. It's just however many places you check in whenever you have a new file come in, just delete the oldest one. But it could be potentially very invasive to think that, you know, here sitting on your phone that the government could get, that a jealous spouse could get, it's a pretty detailed record of the places you've been over the course of a year or more. I thought Apple did a great great job in saying, you know what, let's just limit this maybe 7 days, and then that'll be enough to do what we need to do with it, to check you into locations, to tell you your location easier. But over a year, perhaps, I think too much.
Mm-hmm. And I think they put out already a little patch for the iPhone.
They responded pretty quickly to fixing what they called a bug.
Yeah. How do you define privacy? Some people like being able to check into Facebook or Foursquare. And, you know.
Yeah, I think it's just a question of control, right? I mean, I think people generally understand that Apple and Google can generate geolocation information. And if I want to share on Twitter that I'm tweeting live from Washington, D.C., that's fine. If I want to use a map program to tell me how to get to New York, I think that's fine. It's just when it's being collected and used in ways that you don't know or don't understand, I think then the privacy concerns come in. That's what people say, hey, you know, I told Apple this. Apple, I expect them to tell me kind of ephemerally where I am or how to get someplace. I wasn't expecting they were going to keep a log about me for an extended period of time of all those places that someone could then, you know, read and print out and mm-hmm. perhaps embarrass me or perhaps use for malicious purposes.
Mm-hmm. Ed Felton, what role do you think the government should play in any of this, in defining privacy and protecting privacy?
Well, one of the things that the government does is to protect consumers in situations where their privacy is at risk. And so it's natural to ask questions about what consumers were told about what was happening, what responsibilities does a company have, and what harms could result. And depending on the circumstances, government may decide to act to enforce the law against a company that has stepped outside the law.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. And if you'd like to tweet us, we're at SciFri, SCIFRI. Let's see if we can take a phone call or two right at the beginning. Let's go to Chip in Oklahoma. Hi, Chip.
Yeah, hi. How you doing?
Hi there.
I drive a truck for a living, so I'm all over the United States. I have an iPhone, and I use the map feature, and I use the restaurant feature, and I use all the other little features. And it seems like every time I open up one of those things, it asks me a question. Can we use your current position, yes or no? So it's not, to me, it just doesn't seem like this is just arbitrarily collecting the data. You're still having to say yes or no. And so I don't understand why everybody's making such a big deal about it. It's not like it's just, you know, Big Brother's watching and you don't have any choice.
Do you think that, but peripherally to that, do you prefer that apps give you the option of saying yes or no, or just should you be opting out as the default and then opt in when you want to?
Well, that's what's happening is, I mean, if I say no, don't use my current location, then it's just going to give me a very general, homogenized request. If I'm looking for restaurants in Chickasha, Oklahoma, yeah, and I say no, I don't want to use my current location, then it's just going to show me the restaurants in Chickasha, Oklahoma. If I say yes, use my current location, then it's going to show me restaurants just right real close to where I'm at.
Hmm. All right. Thanks. So thanks for the call.
Yeah.
Ed, any comment on that?
Sure. Well, certainly when you use a location-based service like a mapping service, you'll know that information about where you are is being used, and it makes sense for companies to get your consent. And you'll probably know that some information might be revealed by the fact that your device is downloading a map for a particular area where you happen to be. But then you can ask, what happens with the information after that? Is it accumulated? Is it sold? Is it correlated with other information about you? And you might also worry about whether the information about your location is being gathered even in cases where you're not asked or where you haven't consented. All of these things are possibilities that that we need to think about.
But there's no way you can legislate, can you, all these different possibilities?
Well, certainly you wouldn't want to make super detailed rules that cover every particular case. But I think there are basic principles of disclosure and consent that that make sense in terms of giving consumers a deal that they can understand and protecting people from being surprised by what happens as a consequence of the choices they make in the market.
Mm-hmm. Larry, what about cases where the government is collecting information and you have no control about it? You know, we're here in New York and other big cities, and they're taking our picture all the time on the streets. Even when you go through a toll booth, they're taking your pictures in case you're not paying and they want to send you a ticket or something.
Yes, and of course,
do you worry about that?
Well, and there's also a lot of data collection that's involved with law enforcement and protecting us from terrorist attacks as well. Of course, I worry about that. And frankly, I worry about government data collection much more than I do private corporation data collection. The law is much clearer that the government is more restricted in terms of what kind of data it can collect. The Fourth Amendment, in particular, protects the kinds of information and the way in which government can collect it. But the courts have been relatively generous, particularly since 9/11, in allowing government to expand the kind of data collection it can do without warrants, without certain court procedures. And that is a source of considerable concern.
Mm-hmm. The privacy rights of consumers has gotten a lot of attention of Congress, certainly after this iPhone incident and other incidents that have been happening recently. Senators McCain and Kerry have a new privacy bill they're working on. And next week, a new Senate subcommittee will be holding a hearing on consumers and privacy. Joining me now to talk more about it is Minnesota Senator Al Franken. He is the chairman of that new committee, the Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law. Welcome to the program, Senator Franken.
Thank you, Ira.
Tell us about the hearing. What are you going to be covering in that hearing?
Well, mainly mobile devices like, well, for example, we had this thing with Apple with iPhones and iPads that were tracking your location and then storing it in an unencrypted way on a file. And it, let's say you hooked up to your own laptop and all that information then went on your laptop. So it had stored this information for, you know, almost a year of pretty much everywhere you'd been with your device, and talking about other kinds of mobile devices mm-hmm. as well, and privacy concerns.
Mm-hmm. And you invited representatives from Apple and Google to come to the hearing.
That's right.
Are they coming?
Oh, they are, yeah. We have the Vice President of Software Technology from Apple, and we have the Director of Public Policy from Google.
Is this more of a fact-finding hearing, or do you pretty much know the facts and want to see how the industry is going to respond to them?
I think it's kind of both. I mean, we know certain facts that are troubling, and we also want to find out some of their practices, and we want to get facts from experts on technology and experts on the law and privacy. So it's kind of it's fact-finding for ourselves. It's partly about getting facts out to the public. The public is aware of, you know, certain things like what third parties or how third parties are get information that probably most people don't think they get. So, like, yeah. If you go on an app or if you buy an app, that app will very well know your location, and a lot of people don't know that. Or when I wrote a letter to Apple about this operating system that stored the data about where you've been, we got a call immediately from the Minnesota Battered Women's Coalition saying that this is exactly the kind of thing that they worry about. And in fact, the DOJ says that 25,000 cases of GPS stalking last year, and some of those were on this kind of wireless technology, mobile phones, et cetera, or mobile devices. And not to alarm people, but we just want people to be aware of exactly how their information, including location, but other kinds of information too, are put out there, and give people the knowledge and then the right to mm-hmm. make sure that knowledge isn't shared, that mm-hmm. they don't want shared. Mm-hmm. You know, we believe that, you know, it's great that, you know, I'm going to tell the guy from Google I love Googling, you know.
Right.
The Internet is spawned all this unbelievable, terrific, fabulous innovation. And we want that. We just want to also make sure that when we're doing this, we strike the right balance, and that we have our privacy laws keep up with technology in a way that you know, allows this innovation to continue, but doesn't have this effect of private third parties getting information about you that you don't necessarily want them to have. Some people are fine. You know, I don't care if you know where I am. I don't care if you, you know, if a third party shares my, you know, information that I gave to a dating, you know, .com mm-hmm. and said, you know, where I like to go to dinner. And
but you like, you know, Chianti or something.
You know, some people wouldn't want that information shared, and they should have the right not to have third parties spreading that information out wherever they want it to go.
Let me just remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Science Friday from NPR, talking with Senator Al Franken. In a minute or two left, we have Senator. Any thoughts about people's fear of the government knowing everything about them from these devices?
Well, that's sort of a separate thing, and that obviously, I mean, this kind of, they're obviously connected. I mean, you know, when Madison and those guys wrote the Constitution, they probably didn't foresee, for example, that people would have phones. In fact, I can almost say for certain they didn't. And at some point, the Supreme Court had to say, can the government do wiretapping? What are people's expectations? And they decided that wiretapping was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. So, yes, but we're looking more into commercial, you know, uses of and the private entities, corporations, et cetera, knowing your information. And because basically what this whole committee is about is keeping our privacy laws, have them keep up with technology. And even since the phone was invented, as we know, the technology is just accelerating and accelerating, and that's why this new committee, I think, is so mm-hmm. important.
Well, thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck on your hearings.
Thank you, Ira.
Senator Al Franken, the senator from Minnesota, chairman of a new committee, the Judiciary Subcommittee on Privacy, Technology, and the Law, and he and his committee will be holding hearings on that next week. We're going to take a quick break, but we'll come back and talk more with Justin Brookman, Larry Downs, and Ed Felton. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Join the discussion on our Facebook page or on our website at sciencefriday.com. As I say, we'll have a short break and be back. Stay with us. Now you can support Science Friday and try something for free. Here's how.
This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by Carbonite Online Backup. Carbonite is designed to automatically back up files on PCs and Macs before hard drive crashes, viruses, theft, or other computer problems occur. In the event of a computer disaster, Carbonite helps restore photos, music, financial records, and other important files. Carbonite comes with anytime, anywhere access to your backed up files from any computer, or via a smartphone or iPad app. To learn more about Carbonite and get a free trial, go to carbonite.com and enter the code SCIENCEFRIDAY. To secure your files and support Science Friday, go to carbonite.com and enter the code SCIENCEFRIDAY. Back to you, Ira.
Thanks, everyone, for your attention. Now back to the show. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. We're talking this hour about consumer electronics and privacy and the corporations that want data from you. What happens to them? Do you know what's going on with them? What do they do with them? Our guests are Justin Brookman, who is Director of Consumer Privacy at the Center for Democracy and Technology, Larry Downs, author of The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age. Edward Felton is Chief Technologist for the Federal Trade Commission. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Justin, you know, a lot of times people, as they are telling us, they don't mind giving out the information if they know what's happening to it. But isn't it the case that some companies own many other companies? They're like an umbrella group, and you really don't know where the other stuff may be going to.
Yeah, it's not just for umbrella companies, it's any companies. So you think about on mobile phones, like Android did a pretty good job of explaining what you're going to give to Angry Birds or to Yelp, right? They say, you know, they're going to access your location, they're going to access maybe your phone number, and then you say, yeah, I'm fine with that. But then, like, what Yelp does with that on the back end, you know, you have no control over, no insight into. I mean, most of these apps don't even have privacy policies. So if you wanted to find the fine print and look and see who they're selling it to, or what other purposes they might be using it for, or how long they're keeping your data, you really can't even figure it out.
Mm-hmm. And there are companies that, for example, Urban or Dictionary or Third Party, they are all owned by the same people. And well, let's say you may give your data to for restaurant stuff, and it winds up going to a dating service, something like that.
Right. Like, I think the company that owns Match.com also owns like Dictionary.com and College Humor, and you know, all these media companies aggregate, and they have all these different properties, and it's pretty easy for them to share without consumers having any idea what's going on. But by the same token, you know, it doesn't mm-hmm. really matter if they're owned or not. They could mm-hmm. sell the information back and forth in ways that aren't at all transparent to you.
Now, you're going to be testifying in front of that Senator Franken's committee next week, correct?
I am.
And what do you want to tell them, and what do you want to hear from that committee?
Well, I think they asked me to talk about the existing law in this area, and you heard Senator Franken talk about how the law hasn't really kept up with technology. I mean, the law, we don't really have much of a privacy law here in this country. We're like one of two developed nations, us and Turkey, that don't have a baseline privacy law that requires companies to tell you, you know, what they're taking from you, who they're giving it to, you know, giving you some basic control over that information. And then when they're done with it, getting rid of it, right? Like in the Apple example, maybe they should not have been keeping it as long as they did without having a real legitimate business purpose. And so, you know, this has been the case for a long time. You know, this has been the case since the 70s when data brokers first came up. But in the online environment, in the mobile environment especially, the information sharing is getting much more promiscuous. There are a lot more intermediaries who collect and sell data about you, who see information about you. The information about you gets sent around much more quickly, and because storage costs are so low these days, they just keep it around forever, right? A couple days ago, I testified on the Sony data breach, right? They were keeping credit card information from 4 years ago. They weren't using it. They were just keeping it around because it's rarely someone's job in a company to go around and just go get rid of data, to delete data. It's just, as the FTC has often said, it's sometimes cheaper just to keep it around.
Mm-hmm. Ed Felton, tell us a little bit more about how strict the laws in Europe are compared to what they are here.
Well, the Europeans, in some respects, take a different view. European law is built around a concept of data protection, which to them means that companies often have different sorts of responsibilities about data that they're holding. The U.S. tends to rely more on a sort of notice and a model of notice and tends to allow more freewheeling market. And so it's a balance that's drawn in some cases in a slightly different way, although obviously companies that operate across international barriers have to be compliant with all the laws wherever they're doing business.
Mm-hmm. Here's a tweet that came in from Ashley, who says, if you're not doing anything illegal, what's the big idea? If people are so worried about it, they still make unsmart phones. I guess you could use those if you don't want to use a smartphone. Anything unusual about that?
Well, there are a bunch of reasons why you might care about this, even if you have nothing to hide. Even if you have perhaps nothing to hide, nothing that you're doing that's improper, there are things that you're doing that you wouldn't want the whole world to know about. When you go to the doctor, and which doctor you go to, as an example. Or if you have kids, your kid may have a smartphone, and you may be concerned about what information your kid is revealing or what information is being collected about your kid. So in cases like that, people do have this feeling that they want to understand what's happening with their data and they want to keep it under control. And it would be a shame if people were scared away from a technology as valuable as smartphones because they felt that using that mm-hmm. technology would lose control of their information.
Well, could they also not find out that, let's say, for example, in certain neighborhoods, people speed. They drive very quickly here. And maybe if you live in a car insurance company finds out that this is that kind of neighborhood, if you live there, maybe your auto rates should go up. Your car insurance rates should go up. Is that sort of a – am I making that up, or is that sort of a legitimate fear?
I mean, that's something that could happen. I mean, there are like sectoral specific laws in this country, and so there's something called the Fair Credit Reporting Act, which governs some of that. And so I think it's an open question whether that would be permitted or not. Though there are things, but for things that are really, really important like credit or insurance, but price discrimination could be an issue, right? And if they look at your car, they see you're driving around the fancier parts of town, they might charge you different prices, right? When you go to buy an airline ticket, they say this guy has money, so let's charge him a higher price. I mean, look, you might like that, right? You might like ads targeted to who you are. You might want people to watch what you're doing and to send you content based on that, but you might not, right? And all we're asking for is to give people some basic controls over that.
Mm-hmm. And there could be some benefit to it as well. I mean, if the people who design the roads and bridges know much more specifically what traffic patterns are, they can make use of that to decide where to expand roads, where to build new bridges, where to create alternate routes when there's, you know, lots of congestion. There's very valuable uses for this information as well that would benefit most, if not all, consumers.
Mm-hmm. Eric? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, think about when you use Google Maps, right, and you see this traffic up ahead. I mean, you can see this traffic up ahead because other people up ahead of you are using Google Maps, right, and their car is going slow, and there's a secondary use of that data that when you're sending back to Google repeated requests and you're saying, hey, effectively you're saying, hey, I'm moving 5 miles per hour, everyone kind of benefits from that. And then the question is, you know, how long is that used by Google? Do they keep it in identifiable form for years, right? Do they use it for other purposes to sell to people in order to market to you? If you drive very quickly, you'll get ads for a Mustang or something. I mean, you may want that. I personally don't care what sort of decision you make. I just want your right to make that decision.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Eric in Denver. Hi, Eric. Eric, are you there? Eric, Denver? No? Yes? No? I guess Eric, maybe he's there and he can't hear us. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Where do we see the arc of this happening? Is there going to be an outcry, do you think, and we're going to settle on something? Or do you think, is industry going to cooperate voluntarily? This is the old song we hear over all kinds of things, whether it's drugs or something like that. Get voluntary cooperation. If not, then you might have to regulate it. Where do you think that might wind up here, gentlemen? Justin?
This has happened before, right? So around the end of the 90s, when the online advertising first started to be a big deal, the FTC got really interested in these issues, and they held hearings, and there was laws proposed, and industry said, don't worry, we're going to take care of it, you don't have to worry about it. Then a new administration comes in, 9/11 happens, you know, privacy is not as sexy or interesting anymore. It's harder to make the case about hiding data when people are focused on terrorists. So there's kind of a lull for several years. And then starting around 2004 or so, there's been kind of increasing interest in this area as data sharing and information got more and more permanent. People started using Facebook and they're seeing the real ramifications of putting information out there and that it's there forever, right? The internet's written in ink. So people are starting to get more and more concerned, and we've reached this kind of – it's gotten louder and louder and louder, the privacy shout, since around 2004. And you know, I think it's going to keep getting worse, right? I mean, worse or better, depending on how you look at it. The Apple issue, I think, raises people's awareness of how much information they're sharing and how much can be stored about them. So I really think we have to see some sort of just basic legislative solution, say, hey, here's what we're doing. Here's what we're taking. We're getting rid of it when we're done. Is that cool, right? They don't even have to do that right now. The only law governing most privacy in this country today is don't go out of your way to lie to people about what you're doing.
But, right? but sometimes then people are not lying. They're making you read 50 pages
exactly.
Of an agreement. And it's all in the agreement if you just read it.
Right. And the FTC has done some good learning on that. And they say, you know what, this is a really important thing that someone would probably care about. You can't just stick it in paragraph 40 of a privacy policy or terms of use. And so last year, they settled with it with Sears, who, when you went to Sears.com, they installed some software. And as part of what Sears was doing, they were actually tracking very closely all the purchases they were making and then putting it up on their website. And the FTC said, hey, if you're going to do something like that, right, that someone might not expect, you really got to be clear and conspicuous about what you're doing and just tell them up front. Mm. Some people might like that, right? There are programs where, like, I can publish my credit card activity to the web And hey, there are people like that. They want to share or overshare or undershare. God bless them. I just want people to know that they're sharing.
But Ed Felton, aren't there going to be companies that are not going to be playing by the rules and always find some way, you know, cat and mouse to get around some of these regulations?
Well, certainly there are some companies whose behavior is not good. And at the FTC, we're an enforcement agency, and we do enforce against companies that step over the line. But I also think there are a lot of companies out there that recognize more and more that privacy is a core part of their relationship with their customers. And if they want to build the trust of their customers, it's an issue where they want to be straight with their customers and make sure that people understand what they're doing and what they're not.
Larry Downs, any comments?
Yeah, I don't expect actually any significant privacy legislation before the 2012 election, and I don't think that's a problem. These privacy panics come and they go with pretty much predictability. You know, when Amazon first started recommending what other books you might like based on what other people have bought, there was a panic when Gmail was first released, and it's, you know, the part of the software looks at your messages to put up contextual advertising. Several organizations and the government asked Google to remove that product altogether. We got used to those things, and we will continue to get used to these things. Now, I do think it's important for corporations to do a good job, I think a better job, of educating the public about what kind of information they're collecting and what they're doing with it. I think they do need to be transparent, but, of course, there is the problem of the 50-page Terms of Service Agreement. But I think most important, they need to do a better job of both predicting and explaining how they're going to secure the data that they're collecting. And I think that's where several of these recent events have shown a real problem, that they really are not following good security practices, the International Standards Organization security features for customer data, for example. If they did a better job of that, we'd have fewer of these panics, and I think things would go much more smoothly.
All right, we've run out of time. We'll see what the government has to say about that in the coming weeks and months. Justin Brookman is Director of Consumer Privacy at the Center for Democracy and Technology. Larry Downs is the author of The Laws of Disruption, Harnessing the New Forces That Govern Life and Business in the Digital Age. He's also a blogger for CNET and Forbes. Edward Felton is Chief Technologist for the Federal Trade Commission. Gentlemen, thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. And Flora Lichtman is here with us. Hi.
Hi.
Our video pick of the week. What have you got for us this week?
This week, we travel to what might as well be the eighth natural wonder of the world, which is in New Jersey, it turns out.
New Jersey. You know what they say in Jersey? What exit is that on, right?
Well, it's about 50 miles northwest of New York City, and it's the town of Franklin, which has been decreed by the New York State Senate the fluorescent mineral capital of the world. Yes,
I'm speechless.
I know, right? Because for me, I didn't know that minerals fluoresced, let alone that there was a capital of
the world.
Of the world.
And it's not in California for something, right?
Right. It's in Jersey. So it turns out that some minerals, and in this area of the world, in this area of Jersey, there's actually 90 of them, that if you put them under ultraviolet light, they'll glow in these really brilliant colors, reds, greens, orange, blue. It's pretty amazing because they look just like normal rocks,
right?
You know, big boulders. And then you flip off the lights and you turn on this UV light and they just zam.
It's hard to describe on the radio what a zam looks like. So the best thing to do is go to our website at sciencefriday.com where Flora has gone underground, right? Gone underground and these gorgeous fluorescent minerals. And she's done a tour on our website. Go to the pick of the week on the left side there, and you can download it on our podcast there. And it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Annette Heist, the senior producer for Science Friday, and I got a tour of the mine. So they discovered a lot of the minerals here because there are two zinc mines in the area, which are now defunct. But at one of these museums that we visit in Franklin and in this area, you can go actually see the mine and how it works, and you can see some of these fluorescent minerals sort of in the walls of the mine, which is pretty amazing too. But you know, the big mystery, there are a few mysteries. One is, why is this area so geologically unusual? And it seems to have something to do with black smokers about 1.5 billion years ago, because they just spew out really a lot of different things.
Right.
And then, you know, the other question is, why do these guys fluoresce? And there's some controversy about even why they light up. One idea is that impurities are sort of doing it. And they know for a fact that manganese, this element, is causing some of these minerals to light up. But there are 90, and the geologist I talked to, Earl Verbeek, said, you know, we don't really know exactly why all of these are lighting up or what.
I love the mystery.
I know.
I love the mystery. So you can take the tour of the mine. It's a mine. It's an old abandoned mine underground, and you actually find tourists down there looking at it at the end.
Yes, some oohs and ahs.
Oohs and ahs at the end. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where when you turn off the lights and you shine that ultraviolet on, it's amazing.
Yeah, it is.
Amazing how bright they get to be.
Really, really bright. You could, you know, think of a black light poster, but
in a
rock.
And there you have it, in a nutshell, in a rock. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com, and up there, Science Friday's video pick of the week. Flora's got it up there, and you can take a look at it. Tell us what you think. Leave us a comment on the website or on our Facebook page, and or tweet it to us. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
I'm Ira Flatto, and I want to thank you for listening and for making this podcast possible. And if you like what we do and you can afford to pitch in, I invite you to go to our website at sciencefriday.com and make a donation. Thanks again.